denied all requests relating specifically to Medicaid expansion.
The ongoing state fight over Medicaid. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, February 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, after a stretch of mild weather, a storm is heading for the interior.
Hiking and skiing enthusiasts and whatever probably should not, go into the White Mountains or the backcountry because it could be pretty nasty.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Doyon Limited, announcing the 2015 Board of Directors election, encouraging e-proxy or paper proxy submission no later than Tuesday, March 10th before 5 p.m. Information at doyon.com.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
The U.S. Senate tonight approved a one-week continuing resolution to avoid a partial shutdown of the Department of Homeland Security. The House is expected to do the same. Earlier today, Alaska's two Republican senators split over a bill that would have funded the department for the rest of the fiscal year. Senator Lisa Murkowski sided with Republican leaders to pass the bill. Senator Dan Sullivan was among a minority of senators who voted against it because it did not include language defunding the president's deferred action on deportations. Sullivan says the president's action on immigration is illegal, and he says his vote against the funding bill is part of his promise to uphold the Constitution. The U.S. House, meanwhile, rejected a measure to fund the Homeland Security Department for three more weeks. Alaska's Congressman Don Young voted with Republican leadership in favor of the stopgap spending bill. A Superior Court ruling that invalidates the state of Alaska's long-held practice of requiring municipal governments to contribute a specific amount toward public education remains in place for now. Superior Court Judge William Carey today denied a motion for a stay of his January decision that the required local contribution is a dedicated tax and therefore is unconstitutional. State attorneys requested the stay after filing an appeal with the Alaska Supreme Court. They argue that the stay is needed so the legislature will know what to do about education funding this year. The Supreme Court is unlikely to rule on the appeal before the legislative session ends in mid-April. In today's denial of the stay, Judge Carey writes the state did not meet the requirements of a stay. Attorneys argued the state would be irreparably harmed if a stay were denied and that the borough would not be harmed if a stay were approved. The state also argued that it was likely to succeed in its appeal to the Supreme Court. Carey agreed that there was some irreparable harm to the state if his ruling is not delayed pending appeal. However, he writes that the borough clearly would be harmed by a stay because it would have to pay a large amount of money with no hope of getting that money back. Carey also writes that the state hasn't shown how it has a likelihood of success on appeal. Carey based his January decision on prior Alaska Supreme Court rulings, and he writes that while it's possible that the High Court will reverse itself, it's not probable. A House subcommittee has stripped Medicaid expansion language from the state's operating budget. The move is a setback for the Walker administration, which has made Medicaid expansion a top priority. But as APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports, the fight may not be over yet.
The House Finance Committee room was so crowded and stuffy that the ceiling fans were needed. Walker administration officials, lobbyists, staffers, and reporters all packed in to see what the Health and Social Services Subcommittee would do with Medicaid expansion. Representative Dan Sadler, an Anchorage Republican, didn't mince words.
We denied all requests relating specifically to Medicaid expansion.
The subcommittee proposal slashed nearly $150 million in federal money that would have gone toward expanding the state's Medicaid program. Right now, Alaska's Medicaid program primarily covers low-income families, pregnant women, and persons with disabilities. Expansion would cover people who make up to 138% of the poverty level, or about $20,000 for a single adult. In its first years, the federal government would pay for the expansion in full, and then ratchet that amount down to 90%. When it came to a vote, the subcommittee broke on caucus lines, with 8 members of the Republican majority backing the removal. Representative Les Guerra of Anchorage was one of 3 Democrats who tried to keep the money in.
When the federal government offers 90% funding of roads, we grab that money without even thinking about it. Here they're offering 100% funding that tapers down to 90% funding, and we're saying, gosh, I don't know about the 4,000 jobs that will bring to the state. I disagree with that. I think we should accept it, and we have the information, and we've been given the information.
In response, some members of the Finance Subcommittee expressed concern that accepting the federal money could put the state on the hook for Medicaid costs in the future. But most of the reasons given for removing the Medicaid money had less to do with the proposal than the process itself. Representative Mark Newman, a Big Lake Republican who oversees the drafting of the operating budget, says Medicaid is too big of an issue to deal with as a simple line item.
That's about a $145 million question that we've been trying to get answers on. Co-chair and I spoke to the governor and asked him to introduce some legislation so that we could put that in front of the public.
Newman and his fellow House Finance co-chair Steve Thompson asked for a standalone Medicaid bill in a meeting in mid-February, and again through a formal letter sent on Thursday. Some Democrats on the subcommittee pushed back against that request. Representative Scott Kawasaki of Fairbanks noted that members of his caucus have unsuccessfully tried to advance a standalone Medicaid bill since 2012.
We have gotten a cold shoulder. So when people say we want to see a bill, it bothers me that we have a bill that has been blocked in a committee for the last 3 years.
The bill the Republican majority would like to see would reform the Medicaid delivery system to lower costs, in addition to expanding the program. Juneau Republican Kathy Munoz noted that there was precedent for a case like this during the Parnell administration, where a policy that could have been implemented through the budget got its own standalone bill.
Last session, we were in a very similar situation with the retirement issues. There was legislation that had been filed by an individual member to deal with the retirement issues, but we all felt that it was important for the governor to lead on the issue. This is a very similar situation.
There are some procedural reasons that Medicaid expansion could get more traction as a bill than as a budget item. According to the majority caucus's rules, all members are required to vote in favor of the budget, which means there needs to be some level of consensus on the issue. If Medicaid expansion came through a bill, that instead would allow hardline conservatives who oppose the Affordable Care Act wholesale to come out against expansion, while more moderate members of the caucus could support it. For his part, Governor Bill Walker is not planning to file a Medicaid expansion bill.
There's no need for us to file our own. There's already legislation there.
Walker did leave an opening to move forward on Medicaid, however. He said he is willing to work with the House Finance co-chairs on their questions about expansion and reform.
We'll sit down with them, and certainly we'll meet with them and find out why they can't use the bill that's currently there.
It's unclear what happens if compromise is not possible. The governor does have the authority to veto the budget if it does not include expansion and to call the legislature into special session to deal with Medicaid. But Walker said it was too early to say if he would exercise those powers. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
A powerful storm is forecast to push across the interior from the west tomorrow, KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
National Weather Service meteorologist Bob Fisher says low pressure is expected to combine with a cold front to produce extreme conditions.
Gusty winds and sharply colder temperatures and a quick burst of snow, probably many areas, 1 to 3 inches. And over the higher summits there, it could be near blizzard conditions with poor visibility.
The storm is predicted to impact a wide swath of the state from the North Slope to the Alaska Range. Fisher says winds could reach record levels in some areas, including the normally calm Fairbanks area.
West winds 20 to 35 miles an hour with gusts to 45 miles an hour. And this will occur you know, at valley level as well as over the higher elevations, conditions that are normally not seen in Fairbanks during the winter time.
Fisher says people are advised not to travel over highway summits and to stay out of the backcountry, including the White Mountains National Recreation Area north of Fairbanks, where high winds could result in large snowdrifts.
You know, hiking and skiing enthusiasts and whatever probably should not, you know, go into the White Mountains or the backcountry because it could be pretty nasty.
Fisher says the storm is expected to end in the Fairbanks area Sunday morning. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, blending East Coast education and commercial fishing in a clothing business.
I always really liked the kind of Japanese style fish prints, so I started with a rockfish, and that was, I guess, our first design.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
A cargo ship under investigation in a possible oil pollution case will be able to leave on Alaska after its owner posted bond yesterday. The 600-foot Landavia, owned by Herm Dahlsberg of Germany, has been detained by the U.S. Coast Guard in Unalaska for the past 2 weeks. Kevin Feldes with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Anchorage says the ship signed a security agreement with the Coast Guard to let them leave port.
Part of that agreement, they've posted a $500,000 bond that will be available for any potential future penalties or criminal fines.
The Landavia can now take its seafood cargo onto its destination in Japan. The vessel was still at anchor outside Dutch Harbor this afternoon with Coast Guard officers from the local Marine Safety Detachment on board. Felda says they're working with the EPA to investigate whether the crew mishandled oil waste aboard the ship, among other potential issues.
Whether the proper records were kept, whether there were discharges overboard. These are the types of questions that we look at in all of these vessel pollution cases.
Feldes' office just wrapped up another one of those today. A different German company, AML Ship Management, pleaded guilty to dumping oily bilge water from the vessel City of Tokyo in the Aleutian Islands and giving the Coast Guard in Oregon false oil records. AML signed that plea deal earlier this month. The Walker-Mallott administration announced Wednesday that it's setting up a working group to address the transboundary mining boom near southeast Alaska. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott heads up the working group, which includes commissioners of the state departments of natural resources, environmental conservation, and fish and game. It's looking into longstanding concerns about British Columbia mines slated to open or reopen on rivers that flow through southeast.
We view the entire range of activity on that side, which can affect the waters and the habitat of those river corridors, as important to Alaska's interests and to our national interest, and we will engage and pursue that interest vigorously.
Mallott says the group is just getting started and is gathering information. A new transboundary mines group, Inside Passage Waterkeeper, recently petitioned the administration to seek government-to-government talks with British Columbia's premier. The group wants the governor to ask for a moratorium on new tailing storage dams, including one being tested at the Red Chris mine in the Stikeen River watershed. Mallott says he's not yet ready to pursue any particular course of action.
My desire is that we not seek specific responses until we understand fully what we are engaged with. But that doesn't mean that anything is off the table either.
BC Premier Christy Clark is an ardent advocate of mining. She's added staff to the provincial mining agency to speed permitting so new projects can open sooner. Bill Bennett, her energy and mines minister, came to Anchorage in November to explain his government's approach and actions. He met with state officials and addressed Alaska's Mining Association, but he says he realizes he was not with the right people.
we need to make a second trip. Whether I go along on that trip or not is still up in the air, but we certainly need to reach out and give the people of Southeast Alaska an opportunity to meet and talk to our officials.
Bennett wants to engage fisheries and tribal groups where provincial officials can explain their mine review process. It's unclear whether environmental groups will be included.
Anyone who wants to sit down and have a rational, well-informed discussion, we're prepared to meet with them. We're not really going to come to Alaska and be lectured.
We would welcome the Mining Minister Bill Bennett with open arms.
Rob Sanderson Jr. co-chairs the United Tribal Transboundary Mining Working Group. He's also a vice president of the Tlingit Haida Central Council. Both groups cite August's Mount Polly tailings dam breach in eastern British Columbia. A report reviewing what went wrong there estimated a similar dam would fail every 5 years, releasing hazardous water and rock.
That's one thing that's been lacking is consultation, transparency.
The date and location of the British Columbia Mine Ministry's visit have not been set. I'm Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
A tractor-trailer owned by Fairbanks-based Colville Incorporated went off the Dalton Highway about 30 miles north of the Yukon River Bridge on Wednesday. Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation on-scene coordinator Tom DeRider says the truck rolled over, spilling between 3,000 to 4,000 gallons of diesel. He says the diesel spilled in a forested area with about 3 feet of snow cover, and state responders and a Colville-hired contractor are preparing for a cleanup.
The snow will have to be removed, melted, and then the fuel recovered out of the snow. It's also anticipated that there's going to be fuel in the duff layer around the trees. Now, whether they try to do a removal around the trees or just clear the area and do an excavation, that has yet to be seen.
DeRider says the makeup of the subsoil will determine how deep the fuel penetrates. He says the driver of the truck is okay. The Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly passed a sweeping air quality ordinance Thursday night that supporters hope will finally begin to clean up Fairbanks' wintertime air pollution. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
After nearly 6 hours of debate and numerous amendments, Assembly members passed an ordinance that restricts the burning of wood and coal at some times during the winter, establishes standards to determine if a heating appliance is producing too much smoke, and sets penalties to compel residents to burn dry wood and use more efficient wood stoves. Presiding Officer Carl Castle put on a referee's shirt at the beginning of the meeting, joking it might help him make tough calls, and he used the analogy to explain why he's voting for the ordinance.
You make a call, if both coaches are mad at you, you probably made the right call.
John Davies, who along with Catherine Dodge and Janice Golub crafted the ordinance, says the Assembly tried to take all points of view into consideration. Assemblyman Lance Roberts, who along with Guy Satley voted against the ordinance, found much to dislike, and he thinks others will too, so much so that Roberts believes the issue will once again come before voters, as it has twice over the past 4 years.
It's really going to create more division. This is a divisive ordinance, and what has been ensured is that there will be an initiative or referendum on the ballot this fall that we'll have to face because of it.
The Assembly also approved an ordinance that adds $1 million to the borough's wood stove change-out program. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The 2015 PFD filing season is here. If you have questions about your absences or someone you know away at college or serving in the military, the State of Alaska Department of Revenue encourages you to be proactive. Check out the absence guidelines before applying for your PFD. Visit pfd.alaska.gov. Click on eligibility in the banner to learn more. The deadline to apply is March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Josh Edge. This week on AK, Salmon Sisters. Commercial fishing can be a tough and often thankless lifestyle, but one pair of lifelong Alaskans are turning it into an art. They run the clothing line Salmon Sisters, based in Homer, and they blend everything from Japanese prints to cartoons in their style. APRN's Dave Waldron has the story.
Emma and Claire Lakaitis were born and raised on the Aleutian Islands near False Pass. Emma says it was a quiet and simple upbringing.
Growing up there was isolated, and it's really all we knew. We had a really awesome childhood there. We were homeschooled for the first 8 or 9 years of our lives and played outside a lot.
And when the sisters got a little older, their dad started taking them commercial fishing with him in the summers. Claire says they were too young to pull nets, but that didn't matter.
Going out on the boat was a big deal. We were like excited, spent time with my dad, and just spent time outside or with one another.
Once they were old enough to go to college, Emma traveled to the East Coast while Claire went to Vermont. They studied there until eventually they were both accepted into another program, this time in Italy. Claire studied business while Emma studied art.
I started designing some screen prints of the fish that we'd catch on the boat. I always really liked the kind of Japanese-style fish prints, so I started with a rockfish, and that was, I guess, our first design. I guess it just kind of grew from there and grew from our reverence for the ocean and what we, you know, spend our summers doing and what our family does.
And that was the official beginning of Salmon Sisters. Today, the pair sells a large catalog of t-shirts, hoodies, leggings, and more. Emma says the Aleutians have always been a rich source of inspiration for her art.
You know, the quirky people that you find in coastal towns and, some of the creatures that you pull up from the water. They're pretty spectacular.
Claire says Salmon Sisters has found success quickly, but it hasn't been easy, and it's not paying the bills just yet. On top of running the business, both Claire and Emma still commercial fish for half of the year.
It's been tricky. It's like sporadic, like standing at the top of the crow's nest, holding your cell phone up, getting a text to our friend who's running the business and our inventory in the summer, and it's a challenge.
Another challenge for the women is staying true to their values. They want Salmon Sisters to be 100% Alaska made, even if it means paying more to print their clothing in state. For their printing, the sisters use the Anchorage business Shirts Up. When I arrive at Shirts Up, the team is actually making a fresh batch of Salmon Sisters shirts.
Okay, I need to put a little spray glue down to make sure that shirt doesn't shrink up under the flash care. That's a nice one. I like the outline of the fish in the lips. That's really interesting.
The shop is run by Raymond Flores. He says it's true that most businesses can find a way to get cheaper printing out of state.
They say, hey, I can get these shirts, you know, down in Boston, where there's a massive print shop.
But Flores says he keeps his prices as competitive as possible, and he likes to think that he offers more to his customers than a faceless factory ever could. Take the Salmon Sisters, for example.
They do all their sketches while they're fishing, and we get these, like, really, really rough, raw pieces of artwork from them that are like scanned on like a napkin. You could tell they were probably rocking around on a boat. From there, we got to clean up all the artwork, vector it, enlarge it, shrink it, you know, make it workable.
Emma and Claire say they've also experimented with organic cotton and recycled materials for some of their hoodies. They hope to make more eco-friendly clothing in the future, but for now, they're just happy keeping their business in state.
I mean, it's produced in Alaska, designed in Alaska, and sold in Alaska. Like, it's the perfect combination. It's much more important to us to support our local, like, screen printer in Anchorage.
Yeah, and I think we've all learned that Alaska's just not cheap.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, both Emma and Claire think Alaskans will also be willing to pay a little more for something close to their hearts. Emma says two sisters who grew up fishing isn't unique to Alaska, but it's genuine.
I think people just love to be involved in a story. And if there is one that, you know, seems legitimate and real and something they can wear and celebrate too, that is a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, it's so wonderful. Like, just driving from our house to the radio station, we saw three different people with our apparel on. And it's just like, yes, it's great.
For AK, I'm Dave Waldron.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're heading to Mud Bay, right near Haines.
My name is Melina Shields and I live in Mud Bay, Alaska. I'm an artist, a puppeteer, and a massage therapist to pay the bills. It's a peninsula, the southern end of peninsula, south of Haines, surrounded on both sides by water. Chilkat Inlet on one side, Chilkoot on the other. Mountains rise right straight out of the water. It's pretty scenic. There's an old cannery, many rocky beaches. It's quite beautiful. In the area that I live, you have to either take a boat or walk at low tide to access it. As far as year-round residents, we have about 6 houses over there that are occupied on a regular basis, I think. A lot of hand-built homes that people have been working on for 20 years. A lot of miraculous and beautiful gardens. Also, just people love to get outside. A lot of my neighbors hike every moment that the sun is out, and when the sun isn't out, too. In the whole Mud Bay area, that includes across Flat Bay and the rest of the peninsula, there are a lot of artists, a lot of people making music, a lot of people making yard art and puppets and glass mosaics and paintings and crazy sculptures, all kinds of things. I think aside from a fair number of artist studios and one gallery, the only business in the area is an old cannery, which is still operating as a fish buying and processing area, Letnikoff. I love the south-facing exposure, and I love watching the tide come in and out, and I love always knowing what the moon is doing in relation to the tides. I think it's unique to actually pay attention to the, to have to pay attention to that, and that's one of my favorite parts.
Melina Shields is an artist and massage therapist who lives in Mud Bay, Alaska. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Dave Waldron, Emily Files, Shady Grove Oliver, and Annie Fite. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Josh Edge.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. If you're 50 or over, this message is for you. Preventing colon cancer or finding it early doesn't have to be expensive. Most insurance plans and Medicare help pay for screening, and there are simple, affordable tests available that can be done in the privacy of your own home. Talk with your doctor about colon screening today. More at alaskacolonhealth.org. This message sponsored by Ride for Life.
Alaska Pacific University now offers the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. More at 1-800-272-7528. This message is sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.